This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Spellmonger, Book One of the Spellmonger series, written by Terry Mancor, performed by John Lee. Chapter One, The Bell of Minden's Hall. The westlands of the Olshari Wilderlands are a remote region, filled with a robust people, brave and strong. Yet they are a peaceful folk who have seen little of the feudal struggles of the eastern duchies, apart from issues of dynastic dispute or the occasional territorial disagreement. There is little for them to fear in their rich mountain freeholds. Rode Brother Ostus, wandering the wilderlands of Alshar. I awoke with a hangover to the unpleasant and unwelcome sound of the village bell. You'd expect a bell to tinkle merrily. There was no merriment in this toll. This bell was a locally produced, crudely forged iron affair that lived in a rickety, rough stone bell tower in the middle of the tiny mountain hamlet that was my home. It had a forlorn, off-pitch ring that you could hear for miles throughout the vales. This close, with this much of a hangover, it sounded like a particularly sadistic demon pitifully calling my name. Min, Min, Min. For a bare, confusing instant, I thought I was back in the jungles of Faris during my stint in the army, except that I wasn't pouring with sweat. A misty mountain chill enveloped me instead, and the smells weren't the pungent aroma of rotting vegetation and continual rain, but the relatively clean smells of mountain grass and damp thatch afire. As I emerged from sleep, my mind still foggy from the previous evening's excesses, I finally realized that the demon of my dreams was actually the bell, and I blearily realized the implications. The village bell only rang when there was a fire or other emergency requiring everyone's attention. I groaned miserably into my warm, welcoming pillow, preferring the smell of the sweet mountain herbs and goose down to the odor of burnt thatch as I struggled to marshal my resources. If there was a bell, I reasoned, that meant an emergency, and almost every emergency would call for the assistance of the trusty village spellmonger. That was me. I needed to go to work. Damn it. Once that thought occurred, my feet, still in my boots, it had been that kind of night, swung over the side of the bed of their own accord, and hit the floor in a manner that was entirely offensive to my head's delicate condition. My feet had better sense than my head, it seemed. An emergency at this time of night was almost always a summons for fire duty, or some medical issue, or a missing favored goat, or something else important to the local peasants. I had spells for that. I encouraged my protesting head to work properly as I rose and shook myself awake. I could smell smoke, so it was probably a fire. The fire would have to be one of the close-by farmsteads, too, I reasoned, because I had spells on the village as a whole to prevent such things within the bounds of the hedgework. But which farmstead? I tried to clear my head for a moment and summoned the energy to do a simple detection spell. It took a moment to happen. Magic and alcohol don't mix well. This sort of spell is easy and it doesn't take much energy, thank Ishi, because at the time I didn't have much. It's the sort of minor spell or cantrip I did all the time. And fire is a lot easier to detect than lost goats. I held my hands about 2 feet apart, and a rough mental map of the village swam before me for my inspection. It was an image in three dimensions. It could only be seen by employing mage sight, and it was a spell that had become a familiar tool during my 6-month tenure in the rustic mountain hamlet of Minden's Hall. The preparation had been intensive. It had taken weeks of constant study when I had first set up shop, walking every inch of the tiny village and meeting every person who lived within. But when I was done, the resulting map the spell manifested was as complete a representation of the village as I was capable of crafting. Fire is the easiest element to detect, and my wards were a point of professional pride. I'm really good with fire spells, so there should be no fire. While my protection runes were loosely wrought enough to allow for some flame, else nothing inside the village would ever get cooked, The wards should have quickly extinguished any serious enough unauthorized fire with the intensity necessary to burn damp thatch. Unless something had pushed through my wards. That thought sobered me another measure, and I wisely decided to investigate a bit before plunging headlong into the night. My stomach lurched unpleasantly as I studied the spell, and it only got worse the longer I took. My inspection of my wards in mage sight was clear. There were several areas of excitement that should not have been there, had my wards remained intact. Before the dire implications of that really set in, I heard the first of the screams. A high, panicked, girlish voice that stopped abruptly. I had heard screams like that before, in the jungle villages of Farisi, thousands of leagues south of here. A scream of fear and panic and terror of being woken up in the middle of the night to the sight of violence and blood. The first time I'd heard it, it had been when I'd helped raid a village of peasants whose lords were on the wrong side of the war. You don't forget that sound. My feeble brain knew it was unlikely to be bandits. The village of Minden's Hall lays within Beauval Vale, as peaceful a domain as I'd ever seen, high in the western Minden Mountains, and remote from the trade routes that bandits were traditionally attracted to. Any self-respecting bandit wouldn't starve here, but he wouldn't prosper. There just wasn't enough coin in a primarily barter economy. The local people had little more than cheese and cattle to steal. Professional soldiers or unemployed mercenaries were also unlikely. It wasn't unknown for mercenary companies between engagements to occasionally sack a village out of boredom and need for loot, but there weren't any mercenaries closer than the next barony, or the town of Tudri, leagues to the east as far as I knew. I quickly dismissed the idea of an inter-house war as well. The local lord, Sire Cousy of House Brandmount, was a kindly, mature nobleman who didn't seem to have any enemies that I could tell. He and his younger brother, who held the smaller portion of his domain, got along like brothers were supposed to. Nor was the distinguished old knight engaged in a feud. His borders were unthreatened by his noble neighbors. That left two possibilities. A peasant uprising, which seemed just as highly unlikely. I'd never seen peasants so pleasantly free and content as those in Beauval. Or, oh, crap. There was only one other reasonable possibility. I cursed savagely and reached for my weapons belt as the mage map dissipated from my attention, and I was suddenly very much awake. I hadn't touched my weapons harness in months. The last time was to move it from the foot of my bed to a peg on the wall, and I hadn't even bothered to draw my sword back then, a slender, utilitarian army-issue mage blade. I drew it now and then pushed it back into its scabbard. It was even getting a little rusty. A spellmonger in a remote mountain village just doesn't have occasion to use a war mage's tools. That's why I was way the hell up here in the middle of nowhere in the first place. As impressive as a war wand or mage blade might be to the rubes, as tools they were rarely useful for removing warts, discouraging rats from nesting or finding lost livestock, which is how I spent most of my professional time these days. If I'd had my way, the harness would have stayed on the wall until the spells faded away and the leather rotted. But the leather slipped easily over my shoulders, and I could feel the tingle of magic from the war wands, like I was back in the army again. I hated that feeling. I moved out to the country in the first place, anticipating a long, boring, prosperous existence, capped with a peaceful and dignified death in my sleep, surrounded by my adoring, weeping descendants. I'd had enough excitement in battle for two lifetimes already, and I'd come to Minden's Hall seeking boredom by the fistful. Not ringing bells, burning thatch and screams of terror. As I buckled the belt, I shouted into the darkness for my apprentice, my head painfully regretting rousing him even as I did it. Tyndall was a good lad, a local boy I'd discovered working in a stable when I'd first arrived here. He was quite talented at the art of magic for his age, but he was completely inexperienced at this kind of thing. Indeed, at 14 summers, he was completely inexperienced in most things, but I knew that if I didn't put his idle hands to work doing something useful, he would feel obligated to rush outside to defend his village, and probably get himself killed in the process. And since I had just started getting him trained up decently, that would be a horrible waste of an apprentice. Considering his weight and size, he was also at least as drunk as I was. A local farmer, Goodman Tileb, had paid me 3 big earthenware jugs of the local hard cider for enchanting his scarecrow to repel cornworms as well, and I had quite generously shared the take with Tyndall. 3/4 of a jug had passed our lips, and inspired a long and witty debate about a subject that I could not seem to recall, although I clearly recall being witty about it, before sleep took us just a few hours before. We were paying for it now. Tyndall sputtered and waved pointlessly at the air before the wiggle of my toe succeeded in bringing him back to the land of the conscious. He rose from his cot, still dressed and wearing his boots, I noted, his eyes bleary with sleep, but with expressions of confusion, excitement, and fear vying for victory on his face.
"The bell?" he asked unsteadily. "Is that the bell?"
"Tyndall, get up," I whispered harshly.
"But quietly."
He smelled the smoke, too.
"Fire? There's a fire?"
he asked, his eyes swimming with confusion and alcohol. "Not a fire. Not a serious one, at least," I checked. "But fire is involved. Something is happening outside. Something unpleasant." There were more screams in the distance to helpfully punctuate my report. They did nothing to help my poor head. But it was time to go to work, so I got to work. Damn my commoner's work ethic. I crept over to the window and cautiously peered down from the second story of my shop, out into the uncobbled dirt track the locals insisted on calling a street. I saw menacing shadows moving through the moonless night, and heard growls, shrieks, and more muted screams peppering the cool, damp air. I employed the mage sight spell again, which had the useful effect of letting me see in the dark, though not nearly as well as real daylight did. I could see the shapes below were moving with organized menace, creeping quietly from house to house, weapons in hand. There were a lot of murky shapes down there, lurking in the darkness. I counted 10 before I stopped, and from the screams there were many more. I repeated my earlier curse in a whisper, and fell back before any of them could see me. I had to think. "The village is being attacked," I pronounced. "We'll have to do something about that." Tyndall was crouched nearby, wide-eyed with a fear that was magnified by drunkenness and compounded with confusion. I nodded reassuringly to him, and he relaxed a bit. Then he got nervous again when I pulled a spare war wand from a sheath behind my back and tossed it to him. He caught it automatically and stared at it as if it were a foreign thing. "It has 4 charges. If you need to defend yourself, just point it and say the command word Gerestra. It's Cormiran for camp follower," I explained. "Nothing you can't handle, but you're going to have to mean it if you want it to work. Don't hurt yourself with it. Can you use a bow?"
"Huh? Attacked? Who is it? What is it? Bandits?"
he asked, alarmed, ignoring my question. He crawled over to the window and peeked out himself, but without my stealth. That was not the smartest thing to do. I should have stopped him, I suppose, but I was too busy getting myself armed. I shook my head as I crept over to one of the trunks I kept along the walls of my chamber.
"Not likely," I responded in a quiet whisper. "We're too remote for any serious bandit, or even an amateur, much less a band of them. I think it's more likely that it's..."
"Goblins!"
my apprentice shrieked, far too loudly, his voice breaking unexpectedly and his eyes white with fear. He had reached the same conclusion as I by the simple expedient of looking out the window.
"Master, a whole army of them, at least 30. They're attacking everyone and burning..."
"Keep your fool voice down,"
I commanded reprovingly, "and get away from that window. Goblins might be poor shots and unused to archery, but your fat head will be too big a target to miss." He dropped down below the sill, breathing heavily, his eyes wide with fear and excitement, and his knuckles white as he clutched the war wand with renewed energy.
"Can you use a bow?"
I repeated, as I took my short bow out of the trunk and began stringing it. The boy nodded, wide-eyed. I figured he could, but I'd never asked him. From what I had seen, the Bovoli peasants, as a class, were well acquainted with the bow, if not universally adept. Most lads up in the mountain reaches spent their summers among the pastures, keeping the cows in order and keeping the wolves at bay with some variation of the long Wilderlands bow. There was some incredible hunting this deep in the Wilderlands, if you like that sort of thing, and the famed Wilderlands longbow was a notoriously powerful and accurate weapon, in the hands of someone who had the strength and skill to wield it. I handed him my recurved war bow, much shorter and lighter than the local standard, and pushed the quiver after it. He seemed a lot more comfortable with it than the war wand.
"Goblins!"
he repeated, shaking his head, his young voice a dazed, disbelieving whisper. He hung the quiver at his waist and strung the bow.
"Yes,"
I agreed grimly.
"Goblins."
Around most places in the West, particularly the Wilderlands regions of Olshar and Castol, the peasants called them goblins. In other places, where their race interacts with humans, they're known as scrugs, hairy folk, or most commonly mountain folk. To the ancient imperials they were known as the Casadalane, the low people of the West. They called themselves simply Gurvani, the people. Standing no more than 4 or 5 feet tall, these little furry black creatures live a crude, tribal existence, traditionally inhabiting caverns or crude settlements in remote mountain valleys or stony barrens in the western Wilderlands, like the one I lived in, and to a lesser extent, the mountain chains of the northeast, the Kulin Range to the east, and the jagged central peaks of the Frisian Peninsula to the south. They will sometimes move into arable land no humans are using, to practice some very primitive horticulture, but they hunted and gathered and mined more than farmed. Goblins do not favor grains as much as meat. Ordinarily, they keep to themselves, rarely leaving their vales and caverns except to hunt and trade, or for serious goblin business, whatever that might happen to be. Mostly, they leave us bigger and stronger humans alone. Occasionally, however, some tribal leader will get them roused up enough to stage raids against human settlements for cattle and swine and loot. Very occasionally, a strong enough leader has risen to lead confederations of tribes against humans in force, and they knew how to fight, after a fashion. The series of conflicts, known locally as the Goblin Wars, which ended almost 200 years ago, was the last time that sort of thing had happened. Since then, they hadn't been much of a threat to anyone. Most folk in the East consider them little more than talking animals, if they think of them at all. Despite popular opinion, however, goblins are easily as intelligent as humans, and some even have a surprisingly strong talent for magic. I had witnessed the power of Gurvani shamans the Dutchies had allied with a few times in the mountains of Faris, back during the campaign. They weren't slouches when it came to practicing their own type of magic, and some were as deadly in battle as a human war mage. I prayed to Isha and Brigga and Trig that I would not be facing one tonight, hungover and tired and unprepared. The Gurvani style of magic is crude by ancient imperial standards. So are the iron maces they carry. Both are also extremely effective. It wasn't that I wasn't confident I wouldn't prevail against the shaman. I just wasn't in the mood. I just wanted to go back to bed or throw up, the cider in my stomach protesting all this vigorous activity. I threw my mantle over my harness and then I took only a few more moments to locate the box of knives, darts, and daggers that completed my arsenal. I kept imagining my training ancient was screaming in my ear as I did so, yelling about how slow I was and how many people were dying because I wasn't moving my arse with more alacrity. I tried to ignore that bitter memory. No one likes the ancient who trains them, and the rising pain in my head, and focus on what I was doing. There was no time to distribute my weapons properly, so I pushed a sack of iron spikes into a belt pouch, tucked a dagger behind my back, and tossed a gaudy, foot-and-a-half-long Farisi war knife I'd acquired as a souvenir to Tyndall. He looked nervous and scared as he automatically caught it, but he was ready to follow his fearless master into the night, where the screams were picking up in frequency and volume, and the demon, disguised as an alarm bell, was ringing ever more frantically. It occurred to me that an apprentice, who was frozen with fear and ill with drink, would be little use in his first fight, and likely be among the first casualties if I sent him to war thus handicapped. There isn't much I can do to bolster the resolve of someone else before battle, outside the magical equivalent of a pep talk, but I could at least mask more of the symptoms of his drunkenness. I grabbed his face, looked deep into his eyes, summoned a little more power and whispered a charm over him. His eyes came into focus, and color returned to his cheeks. I included myself in the charm and immediately began to feel better. It didn't exactly get rid of our hangovers, but it did make us not notice them so much. I added a spell of alacrity for myself, on the premise that I would need quick wits and sharp reflexes before dawn, while the magic influenced my apprentice. Tyndall looked relieved. He was still scared. Brigger, so was I, but he was less likely to pass out now. When I turned toward the door, I once again realized that I was a bit drunk myself as the room swam. I was just feeling better about it. I almost took the time to do a more thorough job on myself, but I didn't want to waste any more energy than necessary. This wasn't the first time I would fight hungover. I kind of think it gives me an edge. I could be fooling myself, too.
"Thank you, Master," he said gratefully. "What should we do now?"
Tyndall asked, his voice breaking and his eyes darting around wildly. I looked at him oddly.
"Goblins are attacking our village. We go fight them, of course,"
I said as I threw open the door to the stairs below.
"Let's go."
As I left the bedroom, I held out my hand and called my staff, and it floated obligingly to me. It's a built-in spell that takes hours and hours to do, requires a ridiculously expensive piece of yellow knot coral to work, but the effect is incredibly impressive to the average ignorant peasant. Most magi carry a staff. It's a symbol of our profession, much like our silly pointed hats, and most spellmongers keep a useful array of spells hung on them for emergencies. Being a former war mage, mine had more nastiness than most, including a number of useful defensive spells. I hadn't bothered to refresh them recently, and wondered idly if the spells were sour yet. Like bread, magic can go stale. I could always hit someone over the head with it, I decided. The two remaining wands on my weapon's harness were far more deadly than my staff. I took just a moment to make certain they were there and at the ready. One slim willow wand, about 14 inches long, stained dark with linseed oil and sweat, and covered in carefully inscribed runes, was capable of launching at least a score of slender bolts of magical force, about the size of an arrow with similar effect, against which few mortal armors were proof. The thick oaken wand on the other side of my belt could deliver a massive wave of force, akin to being struck by a kicking horse, and could do so 24 times before it was exhausted. I hadn't used either one in over a year, but the magical tingle I felt as I drew the willow wand from its scabbard told me that time had not dimmed their effectiveness much. If magic can go stale like bread, then war spells are more like hard tack than a soft loaf. We paused by the door to gather our wits and draw weapons. Tin clumsily knocked an arrow, and I took an instant to caress the cloth-wrapped hilt of my mage sword. Slasher, I had named it, across my shoulders and adjust the harness. I noted that 6 months as a well-fed village spellmonger seemed to have caused my harness to shrink a bit, something I could reflect on later. Then I opened the door and we pushed outside to defend our home. All was chaos. I've been in better organized riots. People screamed in terror at shadows, and the shadows screamed fearlessly back. Fires were starting to erupt from a few of the homes, despite my carefully laid spells, as people panicked and spilled lamp oil or dropped torches in flight. And something was still pecking relentlessly against my warding spells. I could feel it. As we burst through the door and into the street, wands blazing and arrows flying, we did not hesitate to start fighting. I elected to toss my staff like a spear into the back of the head of a passing Govani, his club raised angrily to the height of my heart. There were others around us. I grabbed the wand as I felt an arrow whiz past my shoulder. The willow crackled and hissed in my hand as it sent two invisible bolts into the furry pelt of the next goblin I saw, half turned in surprise at our sudden and unexpected appearance. Nor was he alone. Tyndall's first shot had caught one in its narrow jaw, a painful and annoying but not mortal blow, and he was screaming like an injured child at the shaft protruding from his cheek. He dropped his weapons while he clutched his small hands at his spurting wound, which made him an easy enough target to finish off. The third goblin looked at me, dumbfounded, surprised by the sudden assault. He and his mates were crouched over the body of someone on the street before we interrupted, probably looting it. I hope that's all they were doing. The Gurvani had been known to occasionally eat human flesh. I took two steps toward them and nearly slipped. When I glanced down, I saw the body of Goodman Horlan, a local cheese buyer and merchant, separated by a few feet from the top of his head. I had skidded in his brains. It took me a moment to realize, and by that time, luckily for me, my body had already taken control before my stomach could react to the mess. Army training was good for that. I had helped Horlan unload a few blocks of salt just this morning, discussing a fee he owed me. Now I was treading on his brains. For some reason I was really angry about that. Our invaders proved just as angry, as a few more darted from the shadows and attempted a countercharge toward us. Automatically I dropped the willow wand and drew my blade as I called my staff back to my hand to throw a defensive spell. Nothing serious, just a "you stay away" type of thing. It's not a battle staff, after all. But even non-combative wizards like to enchant some common offensive and defensive cantrips in their staves in case of bandits, beggars, or irate clients, if they're wise. Being a former war mage, mine were just a little more thorough than most. My spell at least slowed them down long enough to let me draw my mage blade. It wasn't enough to stop their charge, not really, and they came close enough so that I was soon fighting hand to hand. My sword clanged on the iron haft of the first goblin's little weapon, and before I knew it, I was face to face with my small, black-furred attacker. The specimen in front of me was about 4.5 feet tall, naked, save for a leather belt and iron ornaments, covered in a coat of thick black hair that was glistening in the firelight with fresh human blood. His face was full of fangs and rage as he growled savagely at me, and his eyes glowed like a madman's. He gripped a roughly forged iron mace in his furry little fingers, which he threw over his shoulders as he stopped my blade. A skillful twist brought it toward my face in a swift overhead swing. He was clearly intending on braining me as he had my late neighbor who owed me money. Slasher. 38 inches of enchanted, government-issued, high-carbon alloyed steel and mediocre enchantment stopped his attack in turn, and for a few seconds I remembered everything my swordmaster ever told me. Or at least my muscles did. With a twist of my wrist, I passed the razor-sharp tip cleanly through his throat. I felt a wave of revulsion roll over me as his blood, darker than a human's, but no less red, hot, or sticky, splashed over my hands and clothes. It occurred to some part of my brain that less than 5 minutes ago I had been peacefully sleeping. This was not my preferred way to wake up. I gave the blade a horrible twist to make sure he wouldn't wake up, and we were out of immediate foes. Three Gurvani corpses lay between Horland's body and his head.
"Where do we go now, master?" Tyndall asked, looking around frantically with dazed eyes.
There was blood and black hair on the long Farisi knife in his hands.
"The bell tower,"
I grunted commandingly, scanning the area with mage sight to be sure there were no more goblins lurking in the shadows.
"We'll take action along the way as needed, but we head for the tower," I decided, "if for no other reason than to silence that god's damned bell."
The tower was the village's rally point for fire or other disaster, and that's where all the able-bodied men should be gathering, called by the frantic ringing. It still hurt my head like a demon, and I wanted to put an end to the annoyance. Tyndall nodded and followed me as I plunged into the darkness. Bodies were starting to litter the street I saw. I passed a few more former neighbors and a few more former goblins, as I headed toward the next spot of commotion. The problem was, even with Mage Sight working for me, these little bastards were sneaky. They kept popping out of nowhere, and had I not been prepared, careful and lucky, I would have had my head bashed in, or at least a kneecap, more than a few times. I slew two more Gavanni with Slasher from behind, and smashed another one between the eyes with my staff. He rushed me while I was stabbing his comrade, while Tyndall put an arrow into a fourth before we ran into the first live human we'd seen, Goodman Miklo, the village barber. He was holding a wooden stool in one hand and a butcher knife in the other, as he fended off two of the creatures, his back to his shop and a savage, desperate grimace on his face. A third goblin on the ground at his feet told me that he had been luckier than poor Goodman Horlan. I couldn't help but notice that he fought pretty well for an untrained barber, but I knew that he couldn't hold out for much longer against the pair, who were swinging those little clubs in a flurry against his stool. He had a wife and three young daughters to protect, though, and I knew he'd go down in their defense before he'd retreat if I didn't intervene. Besides, we'd need his medical skills for the wounded, if any survived the night. I decided it was a pretty good time to announce my presence with authority, the way they taught me to at War College. War Magi love that sort of thing, as the sudden appearance of a spell-casting warrior can affect the morale of both sides of a conflict. I raised my staff, and sent a very pretty and barely destructive wad of magical sparks at Miklo's two attackers. It's a flashy, bandit warding spell I'd hung on the staff almost 2 years ago. Seconds later, the unprepared Gavanni were writhing on the ground in agony, while their nervous systems fired randomly. It would only last a few seconds, but it was enough time for Miklo the barber. He didn't hesitate. He carefully stabbed both of them through the neck with his knife, and then smashed the second one in the head with his stool for good measure when having his throat cut didn't stop his movements. "Well struck," I complimented him automatically. Miklo stared at me in wonderment as he surveyed the dead bodies, the bloodied stool still in his hand. He was a barber, no stranger to blood, but not blood extracted by violence. I nodded reassuringly, made sure he wasn't wounded or going into shock, and encouraged him to join me. He nodded firmly in return, relieved once he saw someone else was in charge, and said something to his family behind the door. I heard the heavy bar being lowered behind it. Miklo stooped to pick up a longish curved blade from the twitching Gavanni's dead hands. Despite the smaller handle, it was longer and had more heft than a butcher knife, which he passed back inside to his terrified wife. Poor Miklo moved as if through an unreal dream, his face blank. I've seen that look before, the expression of someone who has never seen violence suddenly thrust into a violent situation. I wore it myself once. I stopped long enough to put a cantrip. That's a small, simple, easy spell like lighting a fire or heating up water or something that you've practiced so often that you can almost do it in your sleep. That would make it nearly impossible to open his door. "To keep your family a little safer," I explained when he asked. "Let's collect some more of our folk and head for the bell tower," I ordered. Miklo hefted his new dagger and battered stool and followed dutifully behind Tyndall. We collected Goodman Brunan, who we found standing at the door of his harness shop, with a long cheese knife, freshly stained with dark blood, held menacingly in his hand. Bru wasn't in a daze. He was fighting mad. He holds a reputation in Minden's Hall for hard dealing and a quick temper, and he was full of both tonight. He happily joined us, and we continued toward the village's bell tower. We saw plenty more bodies of both species along the way. I stepped over them as casually as I could. I'd learned to cultivate an indifference to casualties in Faris, and continued on, while my fellow villagers took turns crying and vomiting when they weren't fighting for their lives. I let Tyndall try to comfort them. I was searching for more allies, and found them. Astol the Saddlemaker joined us next, armed with an antique rusted sword. And then the five of us took on a large knot of the invaders who were just leaving the house of Jowdy the Jolly. They had blood on their fangs, and I didn't want to think about what they had been doing to the friendly family inside the silent home.
My imagination of those events inflamed my attack. We blindsided them with a force and ferocity one might not ordinarily expect from normally peaceful mountain villagers. I had to stop my little band from continuing to pointlessly punish the Govani corpses and encourage them to move on to more productive work. There were others to be slain that night. No need to linger over the dead of either species. We couldn't waste time on idle vengeance, any more than we could waste it running up to the castle to ask for its protection. This was our home. We made for a woodshed behind a cot, which gave us the illusion of cover, and the time to pause for a moment to get our bearings. I could hear all of my men breathing heavily from the exertions of the fight, and the growing cloud of smoke, as I again brought my mage map into view, and noted that the largest concentration of the Govani was actually around the bell tower, where we were headed. There were plenty of stray goblins between them and us, but there were plenty of people, too. If we could convince the latter to battle the former, we might stand a chance by the time we arrived at the stone tower. Two more villagers came up behind us, and were almost accidentally shot by Tyndall while we waited, Goodman Gurris and his son, Guzdal. Both held powerful Wilderland's bows and carried hatchets at their belts. They slapped the others on the back and turned to me, for whatever reason, clearly expecting orders. So I gave some. No one told me not to, after all, and no one seemed to be actually in charge. But I kept it short and simple. "There are two more around this corner," I reported, "then three in the house beyond that. We go as a group, and we don't leave anyone behind. Archers, shoot over our shoulders and pick your shots. Rally anyone else you see to us. Keep your eyes open for shadows. Let's go." The next 10 minutes turned into a frantic, confusing running, house-to-house battle, and thankfully we were victorious in each encounter. As a group, we were starting to outnumber the little bands of three or four who were raiding and pillaging. Better still, along the way we picked up another four men who were willing to fight. All of a sudden, we were a military unit of irregular light infantry, and I found myself elected captain. I was admittedly the most qualified, but I dearly wished someone else would come along and take over. But while we were winning the individual engagements, my men were taking wounds that real soldiers would have avoided, like Guzdal hacking into his own leg accidentally with his hatchet, and Bru's hand getting opened up by a goblin's rusty iron dagger. We were almost feeling victorious about the evening as we approached the commons, but then, by the light of our burning homes, we saw a horrible sight. The bell tower was the scene of the real siege, though it was more riot than an organized battle. There were about 100 Govani tribesmen in the square, throwing stones and javelins at the handful of people who'd managed to make it inside the rough stone building before getting cut off. As a fortification, it was a poor choice. It was only 3 stories tall, of undressed local stone, and there wasn't room inside for more than 12 folk, if they were really well acquainted. But it was also the only reasonable choice, as it had stout walls and a thick oaken door, bound in iron to keep the village urchins from ringing the bell out of mischief. At least one of the besieged was hanging on that bell rope for dear life to summon help. Mothers screamed for their children, children screamed for their parents, and some screamed for their lives, as goblin maces smashed at the knees and feet of those brave or desperate enough to try to escape. Occasionally, the men would throw the rocks and javelins back down at the invaders, and someone with a bow in the tower was making good use of it, but mostly the villagers just hid and screamed in terror. My little band halted by the edge of the village square, and I motioned for them to take cover behind a barn, while I took stock of the tactical situation. I had never expected to use that term again, but my time in the service of the duchies had made me automatically think of such things at a time like this. It was amazing. I hadn't been in a pitched battle in 2 years, yet it all came flooding back to me as if I'd just mustered out. The constant looking around, the attention to arcane detail, the purposeful extension of awareness. All of the War Magi's tools came to me so easily. Too easily. Well, at least I was in command this time. I had maybe 6 or 7 men and a few boys, mostly with improvised weapons and no combat experience. Oh, each had trained in the village militia, of course,
But in this remote province that was as much social ceremony as it was training for war. These men were shopkeepers and artisans, not warriors. They were running on fear, anger and adrenaline, which are not the best ways to approach the pragmatic realm of combat. Several of them wanted to go ahead and attack the large band of goblins right then, but I urged them to be calm, and Ishi's tits, they actually listened. While attacking the foe in the rear sounds glorious in theory, the goblins outnumbered us significantly enough that our glorious gesture would be futile, and as short-lived as we would be. Even war magic couldn't turn the tide against such odds, not by myself. I could drain my wands and staff at the brutes, and there would still be more than enough of them to defeat us. The best we could do was pick off stragglers and wait for help. Help I was dearly hoping would be forthcoming. The local lord of the valley, Sire Kusi, had built his castle only 3 or 4 miles away, and the bell, which continued to ring desperately, could be heard from there. True, he and all of his gentlemen men-at-arms would only add 12.5 defenders to the fray, but they were 12.5 well-trained, well-armed, and mounted wilderlords. Compared to the few shopkeepers and craftsmen I was leading, that was as good as an army. Wisdom dictated we sit tight and wait for reinforcements. Only nobody wanted to be wise that night. People were getting hurt and dying. "That's Leda," Guzdal shouted, spotting a girl he fancied, screaming on the second-floor window of the bell tower. He started toward her automatically, but his father restrained him before I could.
"Enough, lad," the elder whispered harshly to his son. "We'll get them all back proper, if we keep our heads. Rushing in there will just get you and her killed. Let's wait and see what the spellmonger has up his sleeve," he said hopefully.
He wasn't the only one who was eager for that. I was kind of curious what I'd do myself.
"What should we do?"
Astol asked in a whisper. Confused faces looked around for an answer, and then they all looked to me, the relative stranger with the sword, for leadership. And hells, I didn't know what to do. While I was trying to figure it out, we were joined by another small group of 3, local farmers with pitchforks and axes, and again a moment later by 4 more with mauls and picks and other improvised weapons. They were making all manner of unlikely suggestions for taking the attack to the enemy, and I foresaw a lot of stupidity and quick deaths as the likely outcome. If left to their own devices, the untrained men would get themselves killed. It was time to be a leader. "Pick them off," I said confidently, smiling and trying to look bloodthirsty. "Astol, you take 3 axemen and go to the other side of the barn. Snipe at them until they notice you and pursue. Kill any of them that tried to get around our flank that way. In fact, I'm going to try to lure a few your way. When they get to that side, come out screaming like Korbal himself was chasing you. The rest of you wait until they turn, and they will, and then hit them from behind. Hard," I emphasized, hoping my desperation would sound like confidence. It sounded like a good plan to them, only because they knew nothing about warfare. Still, any plan, even a poor one, was better than this chaos. I stuck my head back around the corner and reactivated my mage sight to see them in the dark. Most were clustered around the bell tower. A few were guarding strategic points to head off any stragglers, but a few were just standing around, watching. I picked out a small group of goblins on the edge of the larger mass, slightly separated from the others as they guarded the gateless entryway through the hedge that surrounded the village. Just the sort of unit who would be looking to respond to organized resistance. They looked bored with what they were doing, so I gave them something else to think about.
"The rest of the archers with me,"
I commanded, rounding up the few bowmen, including Tyndall. "Listen carefully. I'm going to count to 10. I imagine you all can count that high. On 3, step out into that space between the barn and the house. That will give you a field of fire on the largest group of them, the ones guarding the gate. Try to keep to 1 straight line. On 5, knock arrows. On 7, fire. On 9, you turn and come back here. Very simple. Ready? 1. It was basic volleying, using a wall of arrows to more devastating effect than picked shots,
Not the sort of archery these men were used to, but easy enough to figure out. As I chanted the numbers, my archers performed more or less as they were supposed to, although their timing was not the best. Still, they managed to send a flight of shafts at our foe at the same time I opened up with both wands. At least half of them hit from the screams. By 10, we had retreated to safety in good order and awaited a reprisal. Sure enough, a band of 10 or so dark furries loped across the commons toward our position. When they were out of sight of the rest of their brood, Goodman Astol and his axemen leapt out at them, bellowing at the top of their lungs. Half the crew panicked immediately and turned to flee. The other half was paralyzed enough by the confusion to get caught by the mob of villagers at my command. They might have been novices at volleying, but they knew how to hunt. The archers didn't let anyone escape.
10 down. 10 times that many left to go, I said, grinning. All right, let's see if we can do that again. This time, fire, and then charge with hand weapons. Quietly. We only want a piece of them, not the whole army. I'll lead. The rest of you do what you did last time.
With that, I sheathed my wands and brandished my staff as I slipped around the corner. Now, my staff is not a war staff, as I have said. It is a perfectly ordinary magical tool that is very useful for making a light in the dark, judging the depth of puddles, and impressing the locals with my mystical wisdom. One doesn't go to war college, though, without picking up a little of the rampant paranoia that flies around so liberally there. While the tool wasn't a full-fledged war staff, I had put a few special enchantments on it. The current situation justified my efforts. I had the perfect spell. This spell was fairly subtle, and I was unsure if it worked on Gervani, but it was worth the attempt, and I honestly didn't have any better options. Upon my silent command, it releases a tendril of magical energy that gets into the target's brain and tells them, "Hey, there's something over here that needs to be looked at." It's technically a distraction spell that we used in the jungle of Faris to eliminate sentries or remove pickets from their posts. As it turns out, the goblins were just as susceptible as the Farisi had been, and a largish clump of 8 or 9 got caught in it. In moments, they were shuffling towards the far side of the barn with what I expect were the Gavani equivalent of blank looks on their faces. Just what we wanted. I took my place with the main force and waited. As the last of the Gavani passed the edge of the barn, all three axemen launched themselves at their backs. Astol in the lead with his rusty old broadsword. It was enough of a distraction to break the distraction spell, but by that time the goblins were whirling confusedly, trying to figure out just why they were there in the first place, which gave my belligerent shopkeepers and artisans an opportunity to lay into them. We managed to slaughter all of them with only 2 minor injuries. The townsfolk were elated at the victory, and I had to keep them from cheering too loudly, lest they alert other foes we were behind them. I would have felt better about it if we had taken care of more than a drop in the bucket we were faced with. But our melee attracted attention from both the Gavani and a few other straggling townsfolk, which was helpful. The archers picked off another 3 goblins as they tried to figure out what was happening, and we collected 3 more men, another one with a bow, who had been on the other side of the tower. That heartened me. With our smaller numbers, more missile weapons would be welcome. Which got me thinking. Astol, good work. Now, take your axemen and as many volunteers as you can find, and make your way around to the other side of the bell tower. These fellows will show you the way. Kill anything that has more hair than you do. That brought a round of laughs and catcalls. Astol was a hairy, hairy man. Once you get to the far side, take up defensive positions, behind buildings, through windows, whatever. Just make sure your backs are covered. Collect whoever else you can along the way. You, Archer, Goodman Henia, stay here with Tyndall. I'll need you 2 to cover me. When your men are in position, Astol, give a shout. I'm going to get these bastards riled up, and then I'm going to scare the shit out of them. Make ready to slay as many as possible. Astol nodded like he knew what I was talking about, when I wasn't particularly certain myself, and started picking volunteers. Nearly everyone wanted to go. That was fine. My whole point of sending off the erstwhile task force
was to get them out of the way and keep as many of them as possible from getting hurt. A few stayed with me, and we kept ourselves busy by ambushing whatever Gavanni nosed around the side of that barn. The archers and I took turns sniping, they with their bows, and me with my war wand, while we waited. Eventually I heard the shout from Astol, and I prepared my spell. It was sheer bluff. My war wand was running out of power, and my staff only had a few useless enchantments left on it. But the rank-and-file Gavanni aren't too bright, as a rule, and I was counting on this. I had the archer, Henir, a lad of 16, the son of the town weaver, tie an oil-soaked cloth to an arrow, and send it sailing to the near edge of the invader's siege. It stuck there, unnoticed except for a few curious goblins, and burned pitifully. The poor quality oil we'd tapped from a lamp wasn't letting it burn very bright or very long. But it lasted long enough. I summoned as much power as I could, draining every reserve in my staff, and fed oxygen to that little flame until it was consuming the entire arrow and the leaves, litter and debris around it, just what I was looking for. I started altering the flow of power to craft an illusion. Before three deep breaths had passed, a fire giant, 9 feet high, had sprung into life behind the Gavanni troops, lighting their hairy backs with a bright yellow flame. It was a crude illusion. I was expending control of detail for size, but it was effective. Fire is the easiest element to sculpt, after all. One moment the tribesmen were wailing against a few miserable peasants in a rickety stone tower. The next, they were being attacked by a flame demon from some forgotten hell. The light from my illusion illuminated the village square and banished the shadow, and for the first time I saw the true numbers of the invaders. Somewhere around 150, I guessed. As most Gavanni bands numbered a few dozen, this was almost an army. Though I was nearly at the end of my power reserves, it was a fairly simple cantrip to add a loud voice to the fire giant. Unfortunately, I knew only a few phrases in Gavanni, none of which were appropriate to the occasion. But I also knew that many of the little buggers also spoke a debased dialect of the language of the tree folk, with whom they were known to trade, and I happened to know a few dramatic phrases in that tongue.
Salavadu nestu kala,
I shouted through the spell, my voice amplified by the cantrip.
I come as death to defilers of my people.
It was a line from the tree folk epic Kaladabu, which I doubt any of the Gavanni had read. Hell, few humans outside of my profession or the scholarly nobility had read it. It doesn't translate well, as the tree folk only use writing to humor us. Mostly they just memorize stuff that's important. The effect, however, was beautiful. The tree folk language immediately caught the attention of every goblin who hadn't already been staring at my spell, and they suddenly looked concerned, if not frightened. One Gervan, with more courage than sense, ran at the demon with his little axe, swinging mightily. He overextended himself and landed in a heap on the other side, his fur smoldering from the encounter and his iron helm askew. A few javelins passed through the figure, leaving it likewise undamaged. It's hard to damage magically flaming plasma with iron. I willed my creation to take a step forward, knowing that it wouldn't last much longer. But the attack on the bell tower had all but ceased. The mass of black, furry faces looked up at the illusion in terror, and a few openly broke and ran away as I added a few more visceral growls through the spell to intimidate them.
"Send a few shots at the front of the group," I whispered to Henir.
He nodded and launched 4 arrows in rapid succession against them. 3 hits, one probably fatal, and the other archers were taking advantage of the distraction with similar effect. Seeing the giant and their fellows falling from the ragged volleys was enough to convince a few more to run toward the hedge. But I'd hoped for more. The rest stood near paralyzed by the sight. I could almost feel their fear preying on their minds, encouraging them to run away, back to the holes that spawned them. I wished that I knew a spell that could do that without the dramatic expenditure of power I figured it would take. Gervani preferred to fight when they have the clear advantage, and the confusing response to their raid had made them doubt themselves. But there always has to be a hero in the crowd. A large Gervani, clothed in black leather armor, which was unusual, and wearing some befanged animal skull for a helmet, leapt in front of the crowd, and yelled something in their gibbering tongue. I didn't know exactly what, but I guessed it was something along the line of, "Don't run away, you cowards! It's only a fire demon!" Like I said, I don't know much, Gavanni, but there were enough treefolk cognates to give me the gist. Tyndall took the opportunity to put an arrow into his thigh, just as I struggled to make the flame man reach down and grab the leader. To his credit, he did not bolt from either the arrow or the fiery giant. He swung his war club bravely at the thing's head instead, ignoring the sudden pain from his punctured thigh as he passed his weapon through it. For a moment, it might have worked. He had the attention of the Gavanni and was proving that a little illusion was nothing to be afraid of, even if arrows were. That picked up their morale. They started growling and chanting and waving around their weapons, even as their war leader's pelt began to burn. I was expending every last ounce of energy I had to keep the illusion going, and was about to run out. The fire giant was losing stature and cohesion as it ran short of fuel and arcane energy. Between the effort and my hangover, I was feeling about as poorly. Collapse wouldn't be far behind. Then the cavalry rode over the hill. Literally. The Wilderlord Knights of Sarkusi had arrived in the proverbial nick of time, some 24 strong, stout lances and long swords flashing in the light of my fading illusion. Just as my fire beast dispelled, the first horseman, Sir Kay, the castellan of Beauval Castle, I recognized by the badge on his broad shield, rode bravely into the midst of the goblins, skewering the leader on his lance with deadly efficiency. I watched with professional respect as he dropped the spear with the still-writhing Gervan on its tip and threw his sword, while his warhorse reared and began stomping on screeching, furry bodies. I'm not a knight, and never wanted to be one. I'm smarter than that. But it was undeniably impressive to watch a man work his trade like that, especially when he was saving my ass. The rest of the troops, each bearing the white bull on a green field on their shields and banners, followed closely behind in a rough wedge formation. Seeing their salvation at hand, my stupid villagers, eager to participate in the coming victory, decided to wade into the rear of the invaders' chaotic formation, swinging their farm implements as effectually as possible. I considered drawing my own blade and wading in, but I had seen enough blood today. My body and mind were exhausted, and ideally wanted a nap. That's when it got my attention. There was a feeling I'd had since I'd arrived at the square, and it suddenly got stronger. I eschewed mage sight and just tried to reach out with my mind, and sure enough, I felt something. There, at the far end of the mass of fur, blood, and bodies, was a single Gervan who seemed undisturbed by the rout that was taking place in front of him. Instead, he was waving his arms like he was swatting flies. Sighing tiredly, I reactivated my mage sight, and he lit up like a beacon. A shaman. And by the amount of magical glow he gave off, I could see he was a potent one, perhaps the most powerful one I'd ever seen. Powerful enough to make me reconsider the whole nap idea. That at least explained how the Gavanni managed to sneak through the wards that surrounded the village without detection. I'd placed the wards myself, and they would have been sufficient against your average bandit, but not much more. I had not thought we needed a more rigorous defense against a real magical attack. A good shaman, or even halfway decent hedge mage, for that matter, could cut through the ordinary wards like harp strings, if they're good enough, just by throwing power at them until they overload and collapse. This shaman was at least that good, and I could tell by the obscene amount of power he was drawing that he was preparing a nasty surprise for Sarkusi and his iron-clad boys. It was time for some action, I realized. The cavalry were fighting against the warriors, but ignoring the shaman who was muttering, not murdering. This was a job for a war mage. Henir, Tyndall, quickly! Loose every shaft you have against that one goblin. There, the tallest one. Don't wait for the command. Just do it, boys! I shouted as I prepared myself. Their arrows were probably going to be ineffectual, I realized. But it was possible that they could distract the shaman long enough for me to do something useful. I had just a few arcane tricks left up my sleeve. My war wand was effective against non-magi, but magically defending against such a straightforward attack was pretty easy if you knew it was coming, and the shaman could not have failed to realize the basic nature of its attack. I could counter if I had time and had something nasty prepared, but I didn't and I didn't. Anything potent enough to finish him off would require real power, and lots of it, I realized, and I had blown almost all of my reserves on that fire giant illusion. It dawned on me that the only thing left to do was... Shit! I'd thought I'd never have to do this again when I'd retired. When most people think of a war mage, those who actually do think of such things, that is, they think of a regular wizard throwing spells in combat. That much is true, of course, but our training at the War College was a lot more extensive than that. We learned wards to guard camps, spells against detection, scrying spells to scout the enemy from a distance, and a lot of other war magic useful on the battlefield. We were also taught how to be effective combat soldiers in our own right, to keep from needing infantry bodyguards while we were in battle, and to give us more of an offensive punch when we attacked. In particular, the arcane war masters at Rilancor had taught us certain special spells that we could use on our own bodies to make us more efficient for the kind of hand-to-hand fighting that could break out at any time in a combat situation. The techniques are complex to learn, mentally exhausting, and sometimes physically painful over time. Not everyone's body and mind could take the stress of basic war magic.